It's a great pleasure and an honor for me to be coming to the Fields Institute and giving a talk here. I'm supposed to switch this on. It does work. So the title of the talk is Polynomial Time Algorithm for Primal T Testing, which we along myself with two students, Neeraj and Nitin, designed last August. And today's presentation, for those of you who have seen the original paper, is going to be a new and improved version of this, our original algorithm and the proof, with many ideas shamelessly stolen from those researchers who made the mistake of writing their thing up and sending it to us. And as you will notice, I'm not going to credit them for it. Okay, so here is the problem. Since it's always axiomatic to begin with the definition of the problem, that given a number n, we want to know if it is prime. And the key word is that we want to know if it is prime efficiently. And by efficiently, we will understand it as that the number of steps taken to test should grow as a polynomial in the number of digits needed to write down this number, which more mathematically translates to saying that the number of steps should grow as some constant power of log of n. Just ignore the last line, makes nothing. Okay, so well, we have all learned this method in this school, that if you want to know n is prime, just try dividing it by all the smaller numbers. You can be a little clever and stop at square root of n. And this method has been around for quite a while. The problem with this method is, as you can see, that in case n is prime, you need to divide all the way up to square root of n, so it's going to take at least square root of n steps. And that's not quite acceptable, because by efficiently, we would want it to be, by our definition of efficiency, we would want it to be grow this time steps to be a polynomial of log of n. So a number of alternative methods are known for this, and most of them are based on Fermat's little theorem, which is a very simple and striking result, saying that if n is prime, then for any a, if you raise a to the nth power and look at that value is equal to a when you compare it modulo n. So this is a very interesting property of prime numbers, which perhaps can be used to test if n is prime. But before we try to put it to use, let's quickly see if whether it is efficient or not. That is, whether verifying this equation is efficient. And indeed it is, because it only requires computing the nth power of a, and then going modulo n, this requires one division, which is very efficient. So to compute the nth power of a, we can use this simple trick that compute a square first, then multiply it with itself to compute the fourth power of a, then square it to compute the eighth power of a, and you just keep doing such multiplications, and you will see that in only order log n multiplications we can reach a to the n. And of course, at each intermediate point we keep dividing by n, so that the number doesn't grow too big. Right, so this equality can be tested efficiently. So here is a very simple potential test for primality. Of course, it doesn't work, but let's go through it anyway. Like for a few a. Now notice that Fermat's little theorem says that for any a, this equation should hold when n is prime. So what we do is, for a few a's, we test if this equation holds. If it does for all the a's, we output prime. Otherwise, we output composite. And what we know for sure is that if for any a this equation fails to hold, then n is composite. So the question is that if it holds for all these few a's, whatever that be, then does it mean that the n is prime? Well, unfortunately, no, because There are numbers which are composite called Carmichael numbers, for example 561, such that all A satisfies this equation for N. So this test, although very simple and promising, doesn't quite work. But nevertheless, this basic idea of Fermat's little theorem has been used to design a number of very efficient primality tests. I will mention them in a moment, but let me just trace the history of this problem a little bit. So primes denote the set of all primes. As we call in complexity theory, we work with sets, and we have this funny looking complexity classes where we try to place every set. So those of you not familiar with this can simply ignore this. So it's very simple algorithm shows that this problem of testing if a number is prime is in the class CoNP, which means that if the number is prime, or no, if the number is composite and we know we are given a short witness for it, we can easily verify that. And the short witness is a factor of n. So if you are given a factor of n, you can very quickly verify that it is, n is indeed a composite number. In around 74, Pratt designed another simple algorithm which put the problem in NP. So this problem became in this class NP intersection CoNP. Around the same time, Gary Miller designed something much more interesting. So he used Fermat's little theorem and put an added condition on top of that. And what he could show was that this his test was correct, that it didn't have that Carmichael number kind of a problem. Unfortunately, to prove the correctness of his algorithm, he needed to assume extended Riemann hypothesis, which is Riemann hypothesis for Dirichlet's L functions. On the other hand, his algorithm was very efficient. It took time only 4th power of log n. And almost everyone believes this hypothesis to be true. So for all practical purposes at least, we now knew already in 73 that this problem has an efficient polynomial time algorithm. The only problem was that we couldn't quite prove that it has an efficient polynomial time algorithm. Soon after that, Michael Rabin modified Miller's algorithm in a very interesting way. So his modification got rid of this dependence on the Riemann hypothesis for the correctness. So what he could prove was that the algorithm now became unconditionally correct. But now the notion of correctness became a little fuzzy, because his algorithm was now a randomized algorithm, which meant that there was a small chance that the algorithm can give a wrong answer. So more specifically, this algorithm was always correct when n is composed, when n is prime. On the other hand, when n is composite, then there was a small chance, you could make it actually very small, of the algorithm coming up with the wrong answer. The algorithm remained efficient polynomial time. In fact, it became even faster than Miller's algorithm, Rabin's algorithm. What am I saying? It became faster than Miller's algorithm. Around the same time, Solovay-Strassen gave a very similar algorithm with the similar properties. So that put this problem in the class CoRP. Again, that's not very important. The important thing is that it is a randomized algorithm which makes an error when n is composite. The next major step in classification of complexity of this problem was taken in 83, when Edelman, Pomerantz and Rumeli further generalized Fermat's little theorem based algorithm. So they took the generalization in a different direction and came up with a deterministic algorithm, which was unconditionally correct. They could prove the correctness of this. The only slight drawback was that the running time of their algorithm was, well, it was efficient, but not quite efficient by the definition that we take, because the running time grew as log n to the power some constant times log 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 of n. Of course, log 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 of n is a very, very tiny quantity. It's somebody remarked that for all practical purposes, log 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 of n is less than or equal to 4. So with that definition in, or that practical perspective in mind, this is the polynomial time algorithm which Edelman, Pomerantz and Romeli gave. But theoreticians were still not happy with this, so they were still trying to get rid of this log 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 of n from there in the exponent. And they continued working on this problem. And in 86, Goldwasser and Killian came up with a different randomized algorithm. This was not deterministic, but a randomized algorithm in the flavor of Miller, Rabin, and Solvay-Strassen. But the novel feature of their algorithm was that their algorithm made an error only when the input was a prime number, as opposed to Rabin's algorithm, which could give an error only when the input was a composite number. They had also another drawback, that they couldn't quite prove that their algorithm took polynomial time. What they could prove was that their algorithm almost always worked in polynomial time, which means that most of the input numbers it would take on, stop in polynomial time. But that drawback was removed in 92 when Edelman and Huang, building on their ideas, got rid of this drawback and came up with a polynomial time algorithm, of course, which made an error when the input was prime. So now one could use, at this point of time, the Rabin's algorithm or Solvay-Strassen's algorithm on one side and the Edelman-Huang algorithm on the other side. So given an input number n, one could run both these algorithms simultaneously on it, and if both agree on an answer, if both say prime, we know for sure that the number is prime. If both say composite, we know for sure that the number is composite. But if one says prime and the other says composite, then we know for sure that one of them is wrong. But we don't know which one is wrong. So that's where the uncertainty comes, and then we have to repeat the same process again and again and again until both agree on an answer. Now, there with very high probability, this repetitive process will stop within a polynomial number of steps, but there was a small chance that it can go for exponentially many steps, and that's what stopped this composite algorithm from being a deterministic polynomial time algorithm. Right, so as you can notice that this problem for all practical purposes and for almost all theoretical purposes as well was classified as having an efficient polynomial time algorithm, but there was a small step that needed still to be taken to actually come up with that algorithm, and that's what we came up with. Now the main idea of our algorithm is again based on Fermat's little theorem. So we start with Fermat's little theorem, and the main idea is to notice the following. Fermat's little theorem works in this ring, that is, you are going to test if a to the n equals a modulo n, which means that we are working in the ring z by nz. And in this ring, well, numbers seem to be same. I mean, 3 is, there is no special property that you can assign to one number which you cannot assign to another number. Of course, there are some properties which you can, but no property which is useful in testing for primality you can assign with one number but not with the other. So in that sense, this ring does not seem to have enough structure to exploit. So the idea is to take this ring and embed it into a larger ring, which has potentially many more properties, and try to use those additional properties to come up with the right test. So what we did was to embed it, to extend this ring into this one, which is ring of polynomials modulo n and modulo x to the r minus 1. So this standard notation for this is this one, but I'll be using a non-standard notation, and will be writing computations in this as being modulo n comma x to the r minus 1. Here r is going to be a small number, so the polynomials in this ring are going to have small degree. So what is additional structure that we get here? Well, firstly, we get this additional strange looking element x in this ring, which is an rth root of unity, and that's given for free. And in fact, that is something we make heavily use of in this algorithm. So let's first start with a translation of Fermat's little theorem for this ring. I'm calling it a generalized Fermat's little theorem. If n is prime, then for any a, we have the following equality in this ring. At x, so like I said, I'm going to use this notation to represent computations in that ring. Then we have that x plus a raised to the n equals x to the n plus a for all a. And it's easy to see that it's a generalization, because if you just scratch out x from everywhere, you get Fermat's little theorem. Okay, so, and I'll not go to the proof of this. It's a trivial proof, really. You can work out in a couple of seconds. Right, so with this new generalization in place, let's revisit the potential test that I designed based on Fermat's little theorem. Now we have an additional parameter to play with, which is this r. We need to choose an appropriate r. Yeah. So the potential test is that for a small r, so we'll fix a small r, and for a few a's, as before, test if this equation holds. We know that if n is prime, then for every r and every a, this equation will hold. And the hope is that if n is composite, then for the r that we have fixed and for the few a's that we are trying, for at least one of those a's, this equation will not hold. And therefore, we will get a complete characterization of prime numbers. Notice that this equation is still easy to verify. With the same repeated squaring trick, we can compute the nth power of x plus a. Of course, now, since these are polynomials, the polynomial degree will keep on increasing. But notice that we have x to the r minus 1 available to us, by which you can mod out everything. So as long as r is small, the polynomial degree remains small, and so we can do everything efficiently. And what we prove is that this potential test is almost correct. It's not quite correct, but almost correct. So specifically, what we prove is that if this equation holds for 2 square root r log n many a's for a suitably chosen small r, so that value of r I'm still not giving, but that I'll fix later. So if all these equations hold, that is for 2 square root r log n many different a's, this equation holds, then ideally I would like then to conclude that n is prime, but I can't conclude that. Instead, what I can conclude is that either n is a prime power or n has a small prime divisor, a prime divisor less than r. And fortunately, this is enough to come up with an efficient test for primality, as given in this slide. So the algorithm is directly based on the theorem I just showed in the previous slide. So input number is n. The first step is to check if n is a power of another number. There are many efficient ways of doing that. So if n is a non-trivial power of another number, then we know for sure that it is composite, and then we stop at that point outputting composite. Second step is fixes the value of r. So here r is the smallest number such that order of n modulo r is greater than 4 log square n, which I am writing as O sub r and with n in brackets. The third step rules out small prime divisors of n. That is, if there is any number less than r which divides n, we can test that just by dividing by 1, 2, 3 up to r minus 1. Remember, r is small, so we can do that. And depending on what the result of that, we can output prime and composite. That is, if any number less than r divides n, then there are two possibilities. If that number is prime and that equals n, then we know for sure that n is prime. On the other hand, if that number is composite, or if it is prime and n is not equal to that number, then we know for sure that n is composite. So we can output appropriately at that point. So this takes care of the small divisor case. The first step takes care of the prime power case, incidentally, because if n was a prime power, then it will be detected right here. So once these two cases are out of the picture, then we have the main test, which is that for every a up to 2 square root r log n, verify this equation. If for any a this equation doesn't hold, then we know for sure that n is composite. And if for all the a's this equation holds, then as the previous theorem said, that in that case n must be a prime number. Now it's easy to see that this is an efficient test. I will not calculate the exact time complexity, I will just mention it at the end. So the remaining part of the presentation I will devote to proving this result, that is proving this theorem that this algorithm works correctly. And surprisingly, the proof is at this point so simple that I can give you an entire proof in the remaining 30 odd minutes. Okay. So the correctness proof. Let's get out of the way simple cases first. If the algorithm outputs composite, then n must be composite. That's very easy to see, because there are three steps in which an algorithm could output composite. It could output composite in step one, where n is a power of another number. Then obviously n is composite. If it outputs composite in step 3, then a small number divides n, and again it's composite. If it outputs composite in step 4, then for some a, this equation doesn't hold. Again, it's obviously composite in that case. So whenever the algorithm outputs composite, it's correct. So let's look at the case when it outputs prime. Now there are two steps in which it can output prime. It could output prime in step 3, and there it would output prime if n is a prime number which is less than r, and then of course we know that it's correct. The remaining case is when it outputs prime in step 5, and that's the hard part of this. So let's just analyze this case. When the algorithm outputs prime in step 5, then what we know is that this equation holds for 2 square root r log n many a's. So the first step I'm going to take is fix a prime divisor p of n. And eventually I'm going to prove that n equals p. But as of now, let's fix a prime divisor p of n. And then I will replace n in the modulus by p. That is, if this equation holds modulo n, then the same equation will hold modulo p as well. for the simple reason that P divides N. Okay, so we have all these equations holding modulo P and x to the r minus 1, which translates to the appropriate ring which sits inside this ring. And the reason for making this transition is the following, that we get another set of equalities for free. That is, here we have x plus a to the n equals x to the n plus a. This is given by the test, and this is given by the generalized Fermat's little theorem. Because p is a prime number, we know that x plus a to the p equals x to the p plus a modulo p. So we have this 2 square root n equalities here and 2 square root n equalities here, 2 square root r times log n equalities in both cases. And if you notice, these equalities are identical except for this n in the exponent here and p in the exponent here. So in this, in a very strong sense, this number n is behaving like this prime number p, and that's what we are going to exploit. So I'll start by giving a name to this property, and I'll define it in a more general way. So let's start with a arbitrary element in this ring, which is a polynomial. Let's call it g of x, and we'll call a number m an introspective number for g of x if this equation holds. G of x whole raised to the power m equals g of x to the power m in this ring. Now, with this definition, it's obvious that when g of x is x plus a, then we have p and n both being introspective for x plus a. Excuse me. And this we can vary this also, because we have 2 square root r times log n many a's here. So we have, for each one of these x plus a's, we have these 3 introspective numbers. One is trivially an introspective number for anything. Okay, the next step is to prove certain properties of these introspective numbers. Actually, I'll prove 2 very simple properties of these numbers, which will be enough to complete the proof. The first one is that the introspective numbers are closed under multiplication. That is, if S and T are introspective for G of X, then their product also is. It's a straightforward proof. Just look at GX to the power ST. Since S is introspective, I can move S inside and replace it by this. Now I need to take T also inside, but I cannot immediately take it inside, because the introspectiveness property for T requires X to be present here, and here we have X to the S present. Well, actually, for most of you, this will look like very silly manipulation, and pretty obvious also, but I'll go through it anyway. Okay, so what we do is we take the introspective equation for t and replace x by x to the s everywhere. So we get g of x to the s raised to the t equals g of x to the st mod p. And now remember that we had x to the r minus 1 here, and that since we are replacing x by x to the s, we get this here. And now obviously this is divisible by this, so we can replace this by this, and we get this. Now put these two together, we have the proof. Okay, so this gives us infinitely many introspective numbers. We started with 2 n and p for x plus a, and now we have this entire set of numbers which are introspective for x plus a. So I'm calling this set capital I. The second property of introspective number is another trivial property, that if m is introspective for 2 elements, 2 polynomials g and h, then it is also introspective for their product. And this proof is not, doesn't even require some silly manipulation. It's a direct proof. G times h to the power n, well, I don't know, I won't go through it, it's trivial. So what this lemma gives us, me, gives us is that we have N and P, and let's just take N. We have N being introspective for X plus A for several A's. Now what I can conclude is that N is introspective for all possible product of these, which means that if you look at any polynomial in this set Q formed by multiplying these X plus A's, where A varies between 1 and 2 square root r log N, and take any, raise it to the any power, so we get infinitely many polynomials in this set, and N is introspective for every polynomial in this set. In fact, not just N, we had every number M in I being introspective for all these X plus A's. So what we can conclude is that every number M in I set capital I is introspective for every polynomial G in the capital Q. So this allows us to increase the number of introspective numbers and number of polynomials for which they are introspective. Now for the rest of the proof, we will be interested in small degree polynomials in the set capital Q, and that I will fix by this parameter T. T is the order of the group generated by N and P modulo R. Since R doesn't divide N, so R and N are coprimes. Well, since R and N are coprimes, that's eliminated. If they were not coprimes, then step 3 will already detect if N is prime or composite. And P divides N, so this, the group generated, N and P do generate a group modulo R, and T is the number of elements in that group. So this parameter will be crucial for the rest of the group. So let's just fix there in our minds. And let Q low be the set of all polynomials in Q of degree less than T. So these are the small degree polynomials that I am interested in. One very simple fact is that this set has lots of polynomials, more than N to the 2 square root T, distinct polynomials. And the proof is straightforward. Well, because Q low has X plus A, which is a degree 1 polynomial, for 2 square root r log n many a's. So it has at least 2 square root r log n degree 1 polynomials. They are all distinct because a is up to 2 square root r log n, and r, well, p is the prime divisor, p of n is greater than or equal to r. Because if p was less than r, then we would have detected in step 3 that n is divisible by a small prime. So all these a's are distinct in modulo p, so x plus a's are all distinct degree 1 polynomials. So just look at all possible ways in which you can form polynomials of degree less than t with these. That number is exactly this. I don't know if you can see this. So that's a problem with Microsoft PowerPoint. It doesn't allow you to typeset formulas in any sensible way. But ignore this. I mean, there is some, it's a trivial calculation which will tell us that there are at least n to the 2 square root t, more than n to the 2 square root t polynomials of small degree. Somewhere along the line, we also have to use the fact that t is more than 4 log square n. In fact, this is the only place where we make use of the special property of r. Okay, why is t more than 2 square root r log n? Well, we chose r such that order of n modulo r is more than 4 log square n. And order of this group is certainly greater than the order of the, greater than or equal to order of group generated by n modulo r. So t is certainly greater than 4 log square n, and that means the square root of t is greater than 2 log n. And now I'm going to change to a field. So far I've been working in this ring modulo p and x to the r minus 1. And I'll collect some basic facts about finite fields, which I am going to make use of. So C sub Rx is the Rth cyclotomic polynomial. and h of x is an irreducible divisor of this polynomial in this ring. And some fundamental facts are that this cyclotomic polynomial divides x to the r minus 1, and consequently h of x also divides x to the r minus 1. Polynomials modulo p and h of x form a field, let us give it a name, say f, because that is a field I am going to argue on. And finally, x is a primitive rth root of unity in this field, which in other words says that x to the I is not equal to x to the j when I is not equal to j and both less than r. Okay, so now I will translate all these equations for introspective numbers over to this field. The introspective number equations were over ring FP x mod x to the r minus 1, but because h of x divide x to the r minus 1, I can just replace x to the r minus 1 everywhere by h of x, and now we are working over a field. And one again trivial observation is that the size of this set, if you look at the introspective numbers n in the set capital I and look at the x to the m, that is the different powers of the roots of rth root of unity, then the number of different roots that this set has is exactly t, and that is precisely because this order of the group generated by n and p is t. Okay. So the first observation is that the set of low degree polynomials that we had, that injects into F. So it maps in a 1-1 fashion to H. And the way and the we associate the natural mapping of this into this, that is, we have polynomials here and we reduce all these polynomials modulo H of X and modulo P, of course. And that gives a mapping from this set of polynomials into elements of this field. And this mapping is going to be a 1-to-1 mapping. The reason is as follows. So let's pick two polynomials f and g, which are different in this set of polynomials, and let's assume for the sake of argument that f equals g in the field. Then what happens? Well, look at this. Pick any m in the set capital I, and let's look at f of x to the n. Because m is introspective for every polynomial in this set, in particular it is introspective for f as well, and the introspective equation translates to the field f, we can continue using that equation over the field f, which is where we are working now. So f of x to the m equals f of x whole to the n, and since f equals g in the field, we can replace f by g and now use the fact that m is introspective for g as well and take m inside. So f of x to the m equals g of x to the m in the field. Now let's look at this polynomial p of capital Y, which is f of capital Y minus g of capital Y. When y equals x, then this polynomial is 0 in the field by assumption. In fact, when y equals any x to the m, when m is in the set capital I, by this fact this polynomial is 0 in the field f. So whenever value of y is x to the n, when m is an introspective number, then this polynomial is 0 there. And the number of different x to the m's, as I just pointed out in the previous slide, in the field are exactly t. So this polynomial has exactly t roots in the field f. But notice that both these polynomials f and g have degree less than t. So their difference is also a polynomial of degree less than t. That's obviously not possible. So our assumption that f equals g was wrong. So it just needs one final, well, two final steps to complete the proof. So now that we know that this set of polynomials of low degree maps in a 1-to-1 way into the field f, let's look at this. Let's go back to the set capital I, which was a set of introspective number, and look at the various products, various elements, various introspective numbers there. So specifically what I'm going to choose is four numbers, A, B, and C, and D. All four of them less than square root of T. And with the property that this pair AB is not equal to the pair CD. And then I am going to look at the products of the form N to the A times P to the B and N to the C times P to the D. Well, an obvious fact is that there must be four such numbers for verifying all this, such that N to the A times P to the B equals N to the C times P to the D modulo R. Why? Again, the reason is that, well, A, B, all these numbers have square root 1 plus square root T possibilities to take. So there are more than T possible products of this kind that we can form using such numbers. Now, order of N and P modulo R is exactly T. So therefore, modulo R, two such products must be equal, and that's what it is. So let's fix two such numbers. Let's call one of them as S, another one as S prime, which are equal modulo R. So here we have two introspective numbers, S and S prime, equal modulo R. The other crucial property of these two introspective numbers is that both of them are less than N to the 2 square root T. Because both A and B are less than or equal to square root T, P divides N, the P is less than or equal to N, obviously. And so this product is less than or equal to N to the 2 square root T. Okay. So let's keep that fact in mind. Let's pick an arbitrary polynomial G in the low degree set we have. And let's, for one moment, look at this ring again instead of the field. Let's look at the G x to the sth power. S is this number. S is, of course, introspective for G. So you can take S inside. It's G of x to the s. Now we use the fact that S equals S prime modulo R. And x is an rth root of unity. So I can replace x to the s here by x to the s prime. And again, using the fact that x prime is introspective for G, I can take it outside. So G of x to the s prime. So what I get is G of x to the s equals G of x to the s prime for any G in this. So this equation holds in this ring. Now I'll switch back to the field. So this equation will hold in the field F as well. And what does that mean? Well, that means that this g of x is the root of this polynomial in the field F. This polynomial is P of y equals y to the s minus y to the s prime. If I substitute y by g of x, we get an equality here, and therefore this is 0. And I could have chosen any g of x for y. Now recall the fact, the simple fact we observed, that the number of elements in this is more than n to the 2 square root t, which means that in the field F, this polynomial has more than n to the 2 square root t roots. But what's the degree of this polynomial? Well, both S and S prime are less than or equal to n to the 2 square root t, the adjacent object. So again, that's not possible unless this polynomial to begin with was a zero polynomial. That's the only possible case. And if this is zero polynomial, well, then S has to be equal to S dash. S, if you remember, and S dash were products of the form N to the A times P to the B and N to the C times P to the D. And crucially, this pair AB was not equal to the pair CD. So everything can't cancel out. So just put this equality and those two things together, and you get, since P is a prime, that N must be a power of the prime P. And notice that the step one of the algorithm already eliminated the case if N was a non-trivial power of a prime. So when the algorithm came up to step five, N could not have been a non-trivial power of a prime. And this argument is saying that N must be a power of a prime. So the only case option left is that N is equal to the prime P. And that proves the correctness of the algorithm, except for one fact, which is the choice of R. I had said that choose R such that order of N modulo R is greater than 4 log square N. and I have not shown you how is that done. So the next slide shows you how is that done. Again, it's trivial. So we need an R such that order of n modulo R is greater than 4 log square n. Well, let's look at the other side of it. Let's look at those R's for which order of n is less than or equal to 4 log square n. Well, if order of n mod R is less than 4 log square n, then R must divide this product. Here, this product is n to the k minus 1, where k varies between 1 and 4 log square n. So if order of n mod R is less than 4 log square n, R must divide this product, obviously. And let's just estimate the size of this product. Just ignore this 1 and just sum up in the exponent here. You get n to the 16 log to the 4 n, which is 2 to the 16 log to the 5 n. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that logs all the way in this talk are base 2. So I'm being a computer scientist by training, I forget that fact to mention. I forget to mention that fact. Okay, so we have 2 to the 16 log to the 5 n here, which is an upper bound on this product size. And we know that every R which has this property must divide this sum, this product whose size is bounded by this. And now let's use a very straightforward to prove fact, which can prove in many ways, one of them being the Chebyshev's estimate on the density of primes, is that LCM of first m numbers is at least 2 to the n when m is greater than 7h. So if you look at the first 16 log to the 5n plus 1 numbers, and their LCM is going to be greater than this estimate, and every R in that range will divide of course that LCM, and that's greater than this. So that means that at least one R in this range cannot divide this product, because if every R in this range between 1 and 16 log to the 5 n plus 1 divided this product, then this and lower bound on this product value is at least 2 to the 16 log to the 5 n plus 1, which we know is not possible. So this shows that there must exist an R within this range between 1 and log 16 log to the 5 n plus 1, and that's small enough because that gives us a polynomial, a time complexity of the algorithm which grows as a polynomial in log of n. If we just sit down and do a quick calculation using some clever multiplication algorithms which are very well known, the time complexity of the algorithm that I showed works out to be around log to the 10.5 n. So there is a tilde here which hides essentially some log log n factors of this time complexity. Since that is much smaller compared to this log n factor, so I'm just going to ignore that. Okay, so what we can prove is that using all this analysis that the running time is bounded by this. But there are some widely believed conjectures which show that an R can, which the appropriate properties can be found in a much smaller range, and that brings the time complexity down to log n to the 6. But that's only a heuristic argument. And very recently, Lenstra and Pomerantz have managed to actually prove that the time complexity of not quite our algorithm, but their algorithm builds on our algorithm, and they prove that the time complexity of that algorithm is indeed log n to the 6. But that is still not practical in the sense that if you really want to use this algorithm to test primality of very large numbers, then you need the exponent to be 4 or even less. For the sake of comparison, the Ramis randomized algorithm, which is the one typically used to test primality of large numbers, has a running time with the exponent of 2. So here is One conjecture which can possibly, of course, if proven, it will certainly bring the time complexity of our algorithm down to the log n cube. And well, this conjecture also has a little bit of history. So our original conjecture, which we put in the paper, has been heuristically shown to be in false by Leinstra and Pomerance. So they have come up with a heuristic argument which implies that the conjecture is most likely wrong. So not to be, I have not taken it as a setback and modified the conjecture appropriately where that heuristic argument doesn't work. And so this the new conjecture is that if n is not equal to 1 modulo r, and then there is this silly condition that r should be at least log log of n, and x minus 1 to the n equals x to the n minus 1 in this ring, then n must be a prime power. So notice that if this conjecture is true, then what we can do is, firstly, we can choose an r which is greater than log log of n and which doesn't divide n minus 1. So r minus r need to be only about order log n. And we can just verify one equation instead of verifying two square root r log n equations. And these two things put together improve the running time considerably to bring the complexity down to third power. I want r greater than log log n. Yes, so r could be actually anything up to log n. See, for if you have a small r, then if you fix an r, let's say to 3, and you allow n to be arbitrary, then probably the conjecture is not true. So you want r to grow with n as well, and grow in a reasonable way. Actually, I could as well have scratched one log from there, and could have just said r greater than log n, which probably I will do when somebody heuristically proves that this is also not correct. Okay, so that brings me to the end of the talk. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.